So, in October 1970, before the Shah kind of closes off Iran from Western observers for a period of time in the middle of the decade, Amnesty International, at the encouragement of a group of Iranian students in Austria, launched a fact-finding mission to Iran. But this trip really didn't end well, and a lot of the fact-finding missions to Iran in this period kind of ended like this. The Amnesty International observer gets expelled. Sabak takes the documents he had collected with information on the political prisoners he was investigating, and the student translator who accompanied him was detained, and he remained detained throughout the decade. To kind of counter criticism that grew out of actions like these, Iranian diplomats abroad would make statements like this. So the Iranian embassy in West Germany claimed that they expelled Heldman from Iran, quote, because he was obviously confused. He obviously confused the University of Tehran with the University of East Berlin. We cannot accept that in our democracy. And you see this kind of stuff all throughout the period. So even by 1975, the Secretary General of Amnesty International kind of expressed the growing frustration of many opponents of the Shah's regime. And in one of Amnesty International's reports, he said, "The Shah of Iran retains his benevolent image despite the highest rate of death penalties in the world, no valid system of civilian courts, and a history of torture which is beyond belief." This is what the Secretary of General said. Okay. So how did this all change? Well, I'll spend the next couple minutes talking about what accounts for this transformation in the global discourse on human rights in my mind, and also within the Iranian context specifically. And part of this is Savak. And Savak had been operating in, since the late 1950s when it was established. But in the mid-1970s, something changed. And this is the way the Iranian Student Association articulated it. They argued that Savak was attempting to extend its dictatorship abroad. So Savak, in a sense, they were operating overseas to collect intelligence on Iranian dissidents. Now, the extent and legality of Savak's activities are shrouded by a smokescreen of competing allegations. Like any intelligence agency, they conduct officially sanctioned operations overseas, but the debate centered on whether or not Savak violated American laws by harassing Iranian dissidents or possibly their American supporters. And a 1979 report by the Subcommittee on International Operations in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee confirmed reports that Savak had indeed established elaborate spy rings in the United States, at one point staffing 13 full-time officers who presided over a larger network of informants. I just found a document at the Hoover Institution that earlier this week when I was doing research that Savak between 1976 and 77 spent $19 million in the U.S., $11 million alone on the Shah's trip to the U.S. in November 1977. So how do people become aware of this? I go through this process in great length in the paper, so I won't recount that here for time. One of the instances that I'll just mention briefly is that a cache of documents was seized from an Iranian consulate in Switzerland by a group of Iranian students who occupied the consulate. And then they disseminated these to a large group of international organizations. So another thing I talk about in the paper is kind of these new congressional internationalists that come onto the scene in the mid-1970s that historians like Robert David Johnson talk about, and how they communicated with groups of students in the U.S. to kind of get information on Iran. I won't go into that in much detail. But how do you, I'll conclude, I guess, with how do we gauge this transformation? Because we're talking about transformations in a global discourse on human rights or global public opinion, or a lot of things you could call it, and it's really hard to gauge. How can you actually really substantiate a claim like that? Well, there are different ways, but you start to see in the diplomatic reports, you see it, and in press reports, in the news media, you start to see talks about Savak and the Shah's regime in remarkably different ways. So in October 1976, the ambassador David Popper warned officials in Santiago that Dina, and this was right after the Letelier Muffet murder in Washington, which I won't go into in much detail, I'm sure you're all familiar with it, but that's kind of all part of this milieu in which all this is happening, this idea of foreign security agencies operating abroad. So Popper told officials in Santiago that Dina was being cited in tandem with Savak and the Korean CIA as a modern variety of Gestapo. So these are American diplomats that kind of start to pick up on this change. You see this in the American news media as well. So in November 76, same time, right after the Letelier murder, the New York Times ran a column titled, "U.S. No Trespassing." And the article stated that The civil rights of Americans, regardless of their national origin, must be fully protected against the evil outreach of foreign potentates. See the same thing, and you know, the Baltimore Sun is talking about opinions on Capitol Hill, and they say the United States must, quote, make sure that its own soil not be treated as open territory for the violation of rights of foreign dissidents. So you kind of see this transformation, at least in the United States, when the human rights abuses of authoritarian regimes like the Shah's essentially come to American shores, which is, I think, a really interesting phenomenon. And by the late 1970s, you really do, you start to see kind of accounts like this in the news media where, you know, in the past 15 years, from at least since 1963 with the White Revolution, you don't see too many negative accounts of the Shah's regime in the news media. You really do start to see this. Jack Anderson and Les Witten of the Washington Post start to print, you know, a barrage of arguments. So I'll just end with this last quote because I know I'm running short on time. And I guess I'll end where I started with a quote from a British diplomat in Tehran kind of talking about the growing importance of human rights in Iran. And this is summer 1977, quote, all the main points which the Iranians deploy in their favor are repetitive, if not hypocritical, and we have certainly had enough of Cyrus the Great's declaration on human rights. So you really do see this shift in, you know, 1975 with Amnesty International essentially saying, you know, the Shah maintains this image as a benevolent reforming monarch, and 2 years later you see a complete different portrayal of the Shah's regime. Thanks.
So I have very brief comments. I'll try to keep them brief. Thank you both for letting me read these wonderful papers. I really enjoyed them. And as much as I am not a specialist in the history of human rights, nor much of a specialist in Iranian history, I will try to do what I can to connect them and see if we can connect it to some of the themes that we've been talking about all day. Both papers explore how the international human rights discourse engages with national agendas. In Mabuda's case, the countries of Sudan, Kenya, and the Democratic Republic of Congo, and in Shannon's paper, the Iran and the U.S.